Hello, everybody, and welcome to Beyond Awakening, the Future of Spiritual Practice. I'm Terry Patton, the creator and host of this series, and I'm also the founder and teacher of Integral Spiritual Practice and the author of Integral Life Practice with Ken Wilber. Today we'll be continuing our exploration of how our spirituality can, under our unique conditions of this time, make good on its promise to uplift and change human life and human society, individuals and collectives, with futurist and visionary Barbara Marx Hubbard, who's often called the mother of conscious evolution. As you may know, I convened this series to serve the evolution of consciousness and culture by creating a really authentic public dialogue about how spirituality can play a real role in helping us find the inner resources that can enable human beings to rise to the challenges of our world crises and really make this obviously necessary transition to a sustainable human presence on our beloved planet Earth. We've already had a rich series of profound and enlivening conversations in which we've focused on many specific aspects of this question. And the way this will work is that I'll introduce Barbara, and then she and I will dialogue for about an hour, and then I'll make some announcements, and we'll spend about a half an hour or more taking your questions, and we'll finish up in about 90 minutes. Barbara Marx Hubbard is an evolutionary educator, a speaker, and a social innovator, and the author of 6 books communicating the new world view of conscious evolution. In 1945, when she was 15 years old and the first atomic bombs were dropped on Japan, Barbara asked the fundamental question, what is the meaning of this incredible, awesome, and scary new power that can be used for the good? What are the positive images of the future that are equal to these new powers? And this defining moment propelled her on her life's quest to find answers for these questions. And the insights that she's gained has led her to a definitive message of hope that this crisis is a birth of a more universal human and universal humanity. So she's currently working with the Shift Network as a global voice for the planetary birth celebration, as well as a guide and teacher for conscious evolution. And as a co-founder of the Evolutionary Leaders Council, she is co-chairing with Andrew Cohen a global dialogue on the meaning of conscious evolution. She's the subject of a biography by Neil Donald Walsh entitled The Mother of Invention, The Legacy of Barbara Marx Hubbard and the Future of You, which was just published earlier this year. And she's a co-founder of many progressive organizations, including the World Future Society and the Foundation for Conscious Evolution. In 1984, her name was placed in nomination for the Vice Presidency of the United States on the Democratic ticket. Her 6 books include the classics Conscious Evolution and Emergence, and her website is evolve.org. And Barbara is also a dear friend and co-creative evolutionary partner. Together, we co-authored an article and presented a paper at the 2010 Integral Theory Conference on Enacting an Integral Future titled The Integral Significance of Conscious Evolution. Among the many things that I adore about Barbara is that she is pulsing with life and impelled by the joy of her evolutionary calling to bring in the new that is wanting to find expression in our time. In the face of the doomsayers, Barbara reminds us that our world crisis, as serious as it is a natural process, that birth is always bloody. Shortly after I really deeply made an evolutionary connection with Barbara about 2 years ago, she was briefly hospitalized, and I was really concerned. And when she was well enough to take a call from me, still in the hospital, I asked her how she was doing. But, you know, she really didn't want to talk about her health. She said, Terry, I was up all night. I was just carried for hours contemplating the question I've been pondering lately. How will the new emergent, all the new emergents, how will they converge? And I just fell even more in love with her when I heard that. How hot is that? The telerotic aliveness of Barbara's passion For years, she's awakened early every morning and communed with the future that's wanting to emerge through her and written in her journal, downloading the new. She's an authentic mystic of conscious evolutionary emergence. And I, too, am impelled by a mission to serve an emerging healthy future. So during our many dialogues, as we explored ideas and co-authored our paper, we often became ecstatic, sparking off one another. The bigger voice somehow came through both of us in a way that was unique. So I trust that you too will be enlivened and activated and aroused by the fresh, optimistic fire that is Barbara Marx Hubbard. So welcome, Barbara. I have a big smile on my face as I welcome you as my guest this morning.
Oh, thank you, Terry. I feel exactly the same way. I'm just snuggled up. It's a rainy day in Santa Barbara. I'm in my favorite chair with a blanket around me, leaning back and thinking of how to enjoy talking to you.
Okay, well, wonderful. Barbara, we announced this as a dialogue about suprasex, which is a term you coined, and I think some people are just totally saying yes, 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 and they're turned on, but probably there are a few who are kind of scratching their heads and saying, that sounds kind of wild, or is that some new agey idea? I'm sure there are some people, at least, that would benefit from hearing a nice level-headed explanation for, you know, rational explanation, why that term and those ideas surrounding it are important and credible. So could you begin by giving us that kind of an introduction as to what you mean by suprasex?
Yes, and by the way, it's suprasex. Sometimes people say supersex, supersex, and it's not that. It's suprasex, and here it's a very simple idea. For the past hundreds of thousands of years, we've had basically two great human drives, self-preservation and self-reproduction. And just starting recently, we began to be aware of the limits of population growth. And now we realize if we were to double our population again, we could destroy all life on the planet. And we're approaching almost 10 billion people within 100 years. That can't go on. Therefore, at the bioevolutionary level, what happened is the innate impulse, especially in the woman, to reproduce, to be able to bring forth out of her body a new being. And the man's yearning to penetrate that body, but what nature is up to is in order to get that sperm and that egg together to create that baby. And it's a huge pleasure, but at the same time, a tremendous amount of work. The minute you get pregnant and you have a child, your life is forever taken in that direction. So what I understood after having had five children is that the urge to procreate is rising up into the heart and into the upper heart, where I think of vocation. It's rising up to express creativity, to express life purpose, to express vocations of destiny, to express the passion that we were born to express and create. And I call this the shift from procreation toward co-creation, from the desire to self-reproduce to the desire to self-evolve, self-express, realize potential. So as the sexual drive to reproduce is no longer the natural impulse to maximize itself in the world, because it will destroy life if it does, I believe that that very same urge of sexual reproduction is expanding into the urge for suprasexual co-creation. Suprasex is our creativity desiring to join with others to create. Another way of saying it is sex is joining genes to have the child. Suprasex is joining genius to give birth to the greater self of each of us and to the work in the world. And when you come together in suprasexual co-creation, you get turned on with your creativity. And nature has put joy into suprasex, just like she has into sexuality. And since we've done so well with sexuality, she's putting, juicing up the suprasexuality to get us to do more of it. And what I've found is that although certainly men share the suprasexual drive, their sexual drive tends to be more dominant, whereas the women, particularly postmenopausal women, 50, 60, 70, 80, and counting, have that drive for suprasexual self-evolution, often becoming the dominant urge. And if that's true, which I believe it is from everything I've seen so far and the logic of it, that one of the great drives that will evolve our planet is the drive for expression of creativity through joining. The suprasexual impulse and pulse of life coming out into our own self-expression and self-actualization. That's what I think it is.
So the exchange of memes instead of the exchange of genes is being activated in something like the way that the evolution was accelerated back when prokaryotic cells became eukaryotic and began to sexually reproduce in a way that's accelerating cultural evolution. And that this is maybe going to be led in some unique ways by women, by mature, wise women?
Well, going back to the invention of sexuality, as I understand it, before the invention of sexuality, the single-cell world basically divided to reproduce. And there wasn't much diversity, and it was a little bit boring. As cells became more complex, they could not divide to reproduce, and nature invented sexuality in such an amazing diversity of ways. But the evolutionary benefit of sexuality is diversity, is every single sexual union creates a new being that has characteristics different than, although including, the parents. So sexuality really is responsible for the evolution of the species in all its diversities of types. And I think that since the evolution of the species is moving up into the cultural now, where it's not so much the transformation of bodies or the new bodies forming out of any form of sexual union, but it's new cultural bodies, memes, ideas that create culture, like genes create bodies. And that's also feeding back onto the body for greater health and greater longevity. And I believe that the postmenopausal woman whose body was able to give birth to the child is, when she gets turned on to her own creativity, is giving birth to the authentic feminine self, the authentic expression of the next stage of human evolution as a woman. Now, that's a big statement, but I'm 81 years old, and I'm absolutely amazed at how I feel. I don't feel younger. I feel emergent, and that the impulse of creativity in me is literally growing. And when it grows, it seems to regenerate the body. And I don't know if this is totally accurate, but it feels to me like my eyes are seeing better. My energy is stronger. Whatever diseases I may have had, I've more or less left them behind. Can't keep up with me. And I coined the word regenopause. Is there may be a pause in the life cycle of the woman who's turned on to her own creativity, in which she's entering a phase of greater longevity, regeneration, and mostly passionate extension of creative self-expression, which has a spiritual base.
Now, as a man listening to this, and as someone who has, I feel like I've participated in this with you in a very juicy and living way, and I resonate with all of what you're saying. There's a there are kind of many different places that we can take this. One of them is that I'm not sure that I feel that there may be some unique things the way that physiology and consciousness are interrelated that women experience that I can't understand or participate in. But much of what you're talking about is completely alive in me. And in fact, there's even a kinds of dynamism that I have with my evolutionary partners who are women that's different from what I have with men, that there is some juiciness that is there between men and women, and that therefore men have as vital a role to play as women, it would seem to me. And I know that you've had, typically across the years of your life, many very, very fruitful and juicy co-creative partnerships with men. So how can you comment on the
yes.
masculine side of this regenopause dynamic and how that might, how that affects men with men with men and women with women, you know, how our partnerships shape up?
Well, certainly it's true for me, starting on the first level, is that my relationships with men like you, Terry, and let's see, Buckminster Fuller, or Dr. Thomas Paine, the administrator of NASA, or many, Stephen Dynan, many wonderful men who share this passion to express and create. It's a wonderful thing, particularly as I get into my 80s, is that I feel with men, like yourself, Terry, a totally pure creative drive, which isn't possessive, it isn't, it's not romantic, and it's telerotic. We joked about that word, you know, we use the word eros for that impulse, particularly Ken Wilber does, and I've extended it into the drive for, it's telerotic, because when I'm with you, just taking our own relationship as an example, when you asked me to do that paper with you for the integral studies and conscious evolution and how they relate, it began to turn on a creativity in me that yearned to be able to understand and do this. And it turned on a creativity in you. And when we began to create, that telerotic drive made us enthusiastic and wanting to carry on these long conversations and not stop. And that certainly affects the man as much as the woman. And I've been, in a way, more attracted to co-creation with men than women in my life. And as I'm moving beyond the sexual realm, there's an extended excitement into the suprasexual, because it doesn't end up with the romantic element, and in some respects there's a greater freedom in that way, because the minute you go into a sexual or romantic relationship, it triggers all kinds of other emotions from our total, you know, biological past, whereas when you move into suprasex, you seem to pick up a creative impulse of spirit. So I think that my relationship with men have been passionately suprasexual for some time. I think as men shift from their patriarchal sort of bondage into expressing their own essential self, that would be almost identical to the woman, because they have to overcome a certain structure of society to be freely suprasexual. which means pure and loving, and it's not competitive. It's giving a gift more than it is being a professional or being superior to others or winning in any kind of game, even though it may include that. But I think that what is slightly different about the woman is that her body has been designed to reproduce the child. That's an extraordinary capacity of a body. And so when she falls in love with the expression of that deep self, and it's an unknown, sort of like she falls in love with the unknown child, and it almost gives her life for the unknown child. The woman, when she falls in love with her own unknown self-expression and purpose and vocation in an evolving world, it's unconditional love. It's not self-sacrificing, but it seems to go beyond the ordinary self, selfish purposes. Very much like a mother goes beyond selfish purposes when she falls in love with a child. Women fall in love with that life purpose and its role in the world. It may be, and I'll ask you that question, do you think there is a difference in the self-giving of the feminine because she has that unconditional quality of really at the hormonal level?
Well, you know, I think each of us is such a unique combination of inner masculine and inner feminine qualities, whether we're biologically male or female, that it probably shows up in a unique way in each person. But I do feel certainly with you, the unique dynamic that I experience with you, Barbara, does definitely have a lot to do with the feminine vivacity of your being, which is both a turn-on in a very enlivening way. You know, we have a completely chaste relationship, but it's a completely hot and lively relationship. I'm turned on to talk with you. You wake up my vocational arousal, and it has that aliveness in a kind of sexy way, we could say. There's a motherly quality that you also express that has to do with care for the whole and a kind of clear-eyed acceptance of the bloody mess that is the birth-giving process. That partakes of a life experience that you as a woman and as a mother of five can express that, you know, is beyond my experience. But, you know, in general, the men who are my strongest evolutionary partners, I think we share something that's a little bit more like taking responsibility and taking care of the whole, and there's a little bit of a more of a warrior spirit or a kind of sense of more classically masculine qualities seem to be generally a little more prominent in those exchanges, whereas with you, the part of me that ecstatically apprehends and feels like I'm a midwife to a birth is much more prominent. So, but I have both of those inside of my own being.
I think that's true. I'm just getting in touch with the feeling of love and appreciation and enjoyment in you, and more of your qualities of your essence start coming out as the co-creativity and the joining of genius. You see, what really happens in joining of genius, ultimately, I think it's like sperm and egg. A new being is formed with sperm and egg on the biological level. It feels to me that when you get anywhere near not just joining genius to share something, but fusion of genius, like we did there when we were doing that particular project, the fusion of genius seems like your genius is entering mine and I am more than I was before I began. It's not even what I might produce in the world about it. But I wonder if you have that feeling that your genius is like a seed, and we do what we can with it, but there's some relationships where the seed starts to quickly, I'm just feeling it as I'm speaking, I'm getting in touch with it. The seed seems to grow more qualities by the appreciation and evocation of creativity from the other.
Yes, yes. Well, you know, part of what I feel goes on sometimes is that there's a, for me, the communion really does have to do with something esoteric. You know, it's the fact that I feel that there's this koan that we're placed with, that we have to, a question that seems insoluble, that we have to find an answer to, that I have to somehow have better answers for than I have today, that has to do with how I can be the healthy, adaptive response of the human being and the human and human culture to this incredible moment in which we really, in many ways, have to remake ourselves. So I'm very alive in that, and I know that you are waking up every morning and journaling and downloading a sense of clarities about how evolution needs to express itself in this moment, how the emergence are coming forth, how it converges. You find new expressions, just like this very idea, supersex, that we're talking about right now. So I feel the aliveness of that process in you, and I have this very alive process in me. So when I'm coming together with you, we're both alive as a question, and your question and my question are not really separate. There's a connectedness. I recognize you as a sister, as a friend in this important koan I'm pondering, and you're asking it in somewhat different ways, and you're bringing in awakenesses and alive, and out of that I'm enlivened in my ability to discharge my responsibility to be with this unanswerable question more fully and more truly, and I come alive, and I feel turned on by it in that process. And then I feel you activated by me, like there was a seed of something in what I offered that you then did something new with. And I just found that there's a the ball keeps coming back over the net, and each time I find something I can relate to, and I can hit it back, and then you hit it back, and it does have a quality that. You know, your analogy to lovemaking, you know, isn't inappropriate, even though, you know, clearly we're you know, there's nothing sexual, literally sexual, about our relationship. It's still juicy in that same way.
Well, that's why supra-sexuality has meaning here. And if you think of it from the point of view just of the energy in one's own, excuse me, in our organism, that juicy attraction that we feel to someone sexually goes up into a juicy attraction that we feel to someone suprasexually, because by being in union and communion and communication with each other, by that attraction, more of our essence or potential gets aroused and expressed. And I, two words have occurred to me as you were talking that expands this idea. One is resonance, and the other is emergence. So when I get in a co-creative, suprasexual relationship, like just now, I feel, there's just some wonderful things about it. I feel attracted, and there's a certain attractiveness in the person. When you're attracted, you become attractive, and you sort of begin to be more of who you are, more sparkly and more juicy and more fun, and you might have been a little bit tired before the phone call, but actually now you feel even you feel great. And then the resonance is a very important word for many of us. It's sounding in almost a vibrational way to that higher frequency in each of us. So the harmonic that comes from resonating, are you there, Terry?
Yes, yes,
hello?
Yes. Absolutely. I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes. That's resonating, resounding it through me when I hear even your voice. And then I give back through my voice what's coming through me. There's a field established within the larger field of, let's say, the universal field. So the two or more in a resonance through suprasexual co-creativity are actually accessing the field. And it could well be that the design of self-evolution requires the resonance and co-creation. Just like to have a baby, you have to get sperm and egg together somehow. Well, we have to get unique essence of creativity together with unique essence of other somehow, through dialogue, through projects, through all these phone calls, through whatever way we can, in order to actually access what's wanting to be born in us. So that's where emergence comes in. That's where emergence comes in. Somebody's calling me, and I have to turn this off. Sorry. That's really where emergence comes in. So it could be, you know, when I probe into this thought form, I realize nature is inventing something as powerful as sex. Now, if you just take that as a hypothesis, the invention of sex created the diversity of the species. The invention of suprasex as an ongoing process, not just an occasional lucky coincidence, but just as what one cultivates. I believe the evolution of the species is inherent in cultivating suprasex.
Mm-hmm.
That's a big thought, but I think it is.
That a delight and a sense of fulfillment that previously people only had through sex and procreation and their children and families and grandchildren,
right,
is now propelling us toward a kind of mimetic creativity that has to do with what we can give to cultural evolution and mutual understanding through art and our mimetic children and grandchildren and our supersexual co-creative evolutionary partners are as alive for us and as primary for us as previously the genetic family was the only.
Right, and just taking it from nature's point of view, like whatever the lovers think about sex, whatever they think they're doing, nature's goal has been get that sperm into that egg. You know, the lovers could have any kind of other view. But it doesn't really matter. The whole thing got invented because of this drive of nature to create more life and more diverse life. It's clearly the drive of evolution. So since we can't keep reproducing up to maximum, and it is also true that sexuality that is, oh, here's a good point, that it is an effort to arouse the dynamic, energetic, and vitality of life, after a while, isn't enough. Because the dynamic vitality of life goes towards emergence, towards creativity. That's nature's impulse, to create more life, more creative and more conscious life. So I think I forgot my point here, but that we're talking about nature inventing the next phase after sex in order to evolve our species and to create the level of understanding, resonance, loving expression to create a society that is sustainable, co-creative, and actually evolvable.
Beautiful. Well, in our exploration of this, then, is what we're doing right now an expression of that suprasexuality, that everyone who is tuning into this and considering these ideas is likely to be part of an emergent cultural process in which some of this is naturally finding its way into their own life anyway, and that you're naming, rather than generating or calling for something that isn't already here, you're more or less naming something that is naturally emerging, and that everyone should perhaps to some degree recognize, yes, that is happening for me. And by recognizing that this is the way that nature is finding its evolutionary path forward, I can kind of affirm and own and feel entirely harmonized with a larger, healthy, emergent stream of life itself and evolution itself, and that this part of me that is excited and turned on by what I can do mimetically rather than genetically, this is healthy. There's a bigger force than me behind this, and my
right.
enjoyment of this is partaking of a greater joy and a greater. There's a bigger yes that I'm participating in, and that I can maybe let a bigger energy fill me, and I can be enlivened even more by knowing that. And maybe turned on to those I can partner with more.
Well, it leads you into what I call vocational arousal. And sometimes I feel we're all teenagers. Because, you know, when you first get a sexual impulse and you're 14 or 13, you don't know how to do it. And you really don't want to do it, but yet you're attracted to, and you feel this change in your body, and nature is getting you ready. And if you have sex too prematurely, or if you happen to get pregnant as a teen, it's not a good thing. So it seems to me that in the suprasexual drive, we first get turned on, and there sometimes is what I call suprasexual promiscuity. You just get so excited you want to do a book with this person and build a political initiative with that person, and then you'd like to go on a trip with the other person. It doesn't matter, man or woman. What's happening is you're being aroused.
Right.
And so that you learn with your vocational arousal to test it out a little bit, just like you would as a teenager. It's like a second puberty. And you learn if you're going to commit to a project to come out of that attraction, like you and I did for this paper for the Integral Theory Conference, then what happens is you have to sustain the suprasexual drive. It's like when you're pregnant, you have to then, when you give birth to the baby, it's not so easy. You know, you don't say, oh, well, just goodbye, now I'm going to go have sex again. Particularly the mother is absolutely wedded to the life of the child. So when you go to suprasexual co-creation and you're vocationally aroused, if you choose to commit to a function, a product, an offspring in that sense, like you and I did with that paper, it was very healthy because it required some work. And you were like a scholar. You went through all the points that I made, and then you made points, and went back and forth, and we talked on the phone, and we finally got a paper that really was greater than the sum of our parts. And
yeah.
When we presented it at the Integral Theory, you and I presented it together, I felt almost like a little proud mama in that we had a baby. It was a good baby. And I think it served people. And
continues to serve them, really, because it's out there and circulating, yeah.
It's out there, and so when you invited me to be on the call on suprasex, and I began to think of all the elements of suprasex as a drive of nature. Then I began to get vocationally aroused even again, Terry. Because it occurred to me that if we wrote a paper on suprasensory,
maybe that's what we need to do. It would certainly be fun.
Well, here's what I was thinking. Like, you have this theory about how nature invented, what was it, sexual reproduction, which speeded up the jump in life
yes,
form.
Yes, exactly. It was not the emergence of a whole new, you know, like when life came into being, a whole new sphere, you know, the biosphere arrived. With the advent of sexual reproduction, we didn't have that kind of an emergence. There wasn't a whole new sphere that emerged. But the speed with which the biosphere was able to proliferate its complexity and expression took a quantum leap.
Right.
And so that was a phase change of a different kind. It didn't bring a whole sphere into being, but it absolutely was a phase change, because the quantitative change in the speed of evolution created a qualitative change in biological evolution, and it was out of that, you know, some time later. It took a while for that to kind of click over. There was another phase change, but then we had the Cambrian explosion.
Exactly.
All the diversity of higher life forms, yeah.
So what I'm seeing here is that you made the analogy in our paper, because I've always been saying we're going through a phase change. And I know some more serious students of integral theory said, Barbara, you're too enthusiastic about this. You've entered a myth. I mean, I've been criticized by people for being always making up a myth on this. I would like to demonstrate that's not so. That the idea that suprasexual co-creativity is ultimately not a whole new life, as you say, a life form, but it is a radical speed up, very much like of diversity and creativity and emergence, just as the invention of sexual reproduction in all its diversity was. And that it could be that as we look back on this, if it's really fully developed as natural a thing as sexuality is, where we have whole cultural mores about how to have sex and when to have sex and with whom to have sex and who not to have sex with, well, maybe there's a whole cultural mores about to come up, is how to have suprasex, with whom, when, and what happens, and what's its import for the evolution of our species.
Yes. in a sense, what's emerging now is that we should be doing now. Let me ask you something. There was one question that came in the instant teleseminar window, was from a woman who said, "I'm most creative when I'm alone. That it isn't through collaboration that I feel like my creativity comes online. It's when I have that solitude, and it's out of that solitude that I birth my most creative expressions." What about that?
Well, I really understand that partially, at least. Like, in my case, I would say that's also true. My fundamental awareness and insights and revelations have come alone, whether it be in my life the planetary birth experience, where I felt the world becoming really one living whole system, or the Christ experience, where I realized that's the next stage of human evolution embodied in that story, and that therefore it meant me and I could become that myself. That was very deeply alone. And then usually in my case, I wrote it down. But that really was like the seed. When it started to be shared and other people caught hold of it, and I was fortunate enough to have resonance with people around these very major internal experiences that came alone, they grew. they flourished.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some artists can do it all alone, or if you're a great writer, you can do it all alone, but even then, it has to get out.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if, I think, I don't want to overgeneralize, but there's a certain dimension to the suprasexual joining of creativity where two people or three or more, it could be what Andrew Cohen calls a scenius, which is a scene of genius.
Yes.
Which is a very a potent idea for me because I love it so much. That all great movements, like the founding of the United States, when they were trying to figure out what is freedom, what are the institutions of democracy, you had the enormous creativity of people coming together to discover that. Or the origin of physics, or the origin of modern art. I believe in the origin of the evolutionary movement, which we're part of. Whenever I'm with two or more evolutionaries who are passionately excited about what's emergent, it seems that the suprasexual creativity is almost a natural and required function.
This is sparking me. So what are the necessary conditions for this supersex to emerge, and what would be the things that would inhibit or prevent it?
Well, that's a very good question. One of the ways I first experienced it was frustration. And this was when I was the wife and mother with the five children in my early 30s, and feeling there was something more I had to express. And so when I read Abraham Maslow, and he said, oh, everybody who's self-actualizing has found life purpose, vocation, that's of service to at least one other. There was a clue. I couldn't get my own vocation or vocational arousal unless I was attracted or serving at least one other. But through my vocation, not just serving in a way that was not my vocation. And so I began to reach out to see who I could find that attracted me. Like Maslow, I called him up and invited him for lunch. And he came. And he told me, well, what you're saying there is your urge to express and create for the greater goodness of life in you. This is the drive of life. And he gave me his list of 300 people before the human potential movement even had a name. He called it the Eupsychian Society, Good Souls. And I wrote to all of them. See, I became activated to find my own vocation. So I've started impulsively and compulsively to find out what attracted me. And then I was able to write a letter that Dr. Jonas Salk found interesting. He called me up, and here was the key to me self-actualizing. I told him everything that was wrong with me. Attracted to the future. I wanted to become more. I was considered neurotic by this frustration, by Freudian analysis. And he said, no, that's not what's wrong about you. That's what's right about you, Barbara. You combine characteristics needed by evolution now. And so that's when I got the idea of being an evolutionary. All right, so this suprasexual drive is needed by evolution now for us to express more than our ordinary jobs or ordinary life patterns. And since we're having to build a society that's viable, it means we have to learn to co-create at a next level. Otherwise, our society will not have the patterns of co-creativity, co-evolution that's required. So this is, I'm going back to the real understanding that it's not enough to do this alone anymore. Even if you are more creative alone, eventually you're going to want to get it out and find others if you want to fully self-actualize.
Mm-hmm. Yes. It's about what we can be. The fruition of your unique creativity still is in something that you can only co-create with others. And therefore, yeah, and there's something about empowering others or being able not to to transcend patterns in which we kind of, there's got to be a deep listening to the other and a real care for the emergent voice of the other to come forward, and the and a valuing of what it is that's more than your own expression for that to be possible.
You see, so if go back to sexual reproduction, getting the diversity through two unique beings joining, and the infant having new characteristics through that joining, not just repeating the parents. So when you join suprasexually, each creative genius joins the other, and nature is creating out of that a new being, both in the two individuals or three. You know, it's not, it doesn't have to be just two. It could be a genius. But then it's also creating a work for the world that has a different quality, I think, than if you were to do it alone.
Right, right. So there's one last question before we take our break and begin to take questions from everyone who's on the line with us, which is, why is this new? Why is there something new here that's emergent? How is this different from the enlivening power of people sparking off of each other and the mutual exploration of ideas and revelation that have made salons and sanghas and meetings among spiritual practitioners and intellectuals so catalytic throughout cultural history? What's new?
I think that it's not totally new, but what's new is the massive shift from procreation to something else. Massive. That means this generation of women and their daughters and sons will have fewer children.
Mm-hmm.
So the vast energy that went into reproduction and nurturing the families is going to be on the loose on humanity. And if it doesn't find a way of joining fruitfully, it turns into depression, addiction, violence, substance abuse, seeking a high. And the high that I get most of is through exactly what we're doing, Terry. I could have been really tired before this call, but now I'm not.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm pretty sure that it's regenerative. At a profound level, on the physical as well as the psychological and spiritual. So the reason it's new is the amount of energy being released from humans having fewer children and living longer lives. And we're talking 50, 60, 70, 80, and counting. And if you look at some of the prognostications here, you know, living up to 100, 120, this is without even the biological revolution or nanotech. But what if we're really going to have a co-creative lifespan? You see, the age of reproduction is minor, and only chosen children can happen. Whereas the age of creativity, co-creativity on this earth and probably in the solar system and beyond, is truly opening up a wellspring that I think is as great as the origin of life or animal life or human life.
Beautiful. Well, thank you, Barbara. We could just keep going on forever, but there are people quite a few people who've typed in really interesting questions in the instant teleseminar window, and I want to get on to those. And then I also want to invite you, if you've called in by phone, to press *2 on your keypad to raise your hand. And if you have a question, there's still time to type that in, so please be invited now to do that. I want to make sure you know how to find out more about Barbara's work. Her website is evolve.org, and there you can find out more about a free teleseminar that you can download, Birth 2012. The book about Barbara by Neil Donald Walsh, The Mother of Invention, and also Barbara's award-winning movies. These and also many other books and educational offerings are available there in her online store. And most importantly, sign up for her free newsletter, The Conversation of the Century, that will keep you informed about events as they happen and how you can become involved. And I also want to tell you about my online course, Integral Spiritual Practice. I am just so gratified about what's emerged from this amazing process that's created this course. I've been researching an integral approach to spiritual practice really much of my life, over 37 years, and I've been teaching it for the last seven. And what's obvious to me now is how essential a really rich and authentic daily practice is to real sustainable transformation and even full human happiness, and how hard it is for people to find their way into a truly transformative practice in today's world. It seems like people have to choose between joining cults and hanging out in profane popular culture where the sacred never gets enough traction to really break us through to another level. So I feel like it's a huge thing to have been able to find a way to take people in just 8 sessions through a step-by-step process that takes you from being a seeker to being a real practitioner in a way that is truly uncommon, really being grounded in the most radical and the most embodied wisdom of the world's most highly awakened spiritual traditions, and yet one that's not a hyper-masculine path of seeking. It's the rare approach that is deeply heart-centered and self-compassionate and humane, but still generates the tapas, the yogic fire necessary for transformation, and engages the body, the emotions, the mind, the soul, the spirit in every moment and in every aspect of life, but not in a way that's overwhelming. So it's in a high-efficiency, simple, doable form that's flexible, not too time-demanding. The first cohort has just been finishing the course, and some people are telling me just wonderful things. Many have said that this program has, for the first time in their lives, enabled them to really make that transition to being a regular practitioner. So it's dispensed online learning course with audio and video and written materials and music, spiritually potent music, and you can download the course materials and proceed at your own pace. But in doing that, you really do join a community of active practitioners whose lives are genuinely changing. So if you're interested in just learning more about it, please go to your web browser and you can type in theispcommunity.com. That's the URL, theispcommunity.com. And please stay on the line, and at the end of the call, I'll tell you a little more about what's going to be coming up with our upcoming guests. A week from today, I'll be dialoguing with Byron Katie. And then in July, Andrew Harvey will be returning for a second dialogue, and there's much more. And then at the end, we'll open up the phone line so that those of you who have called in by phone, we can hear your voices as we all say goodbye. So, okay, let's get into the question and answer section. Remember, pressing *2 on your keypad will raise your hand. Okay, let's see what we've got. Well, here's a really interesting question from River Gobon in Totnes. Does the evolutionary impulse require intentional, purposeful action, or can we simply tune into presence and be spontaneously guided by an unfolding higher intelligence?
I don't think it's either or. I think we are spontaneously guided by a deeper knowing intelligence, and it requires some degree of saying yes. Because sometimes you get an impulse like that and you can be really passive about it, and sometimes you can say yes and take action on it. And I must say that when you have a deep inner impulse, like I did, Barbara, go tell the story of the birth of a universal humanity. Now, that was an impulse, and I could have stayed with that and contemplated that and written about it in my journal forever. I did, actually. But then I said, okay, I'm going to go down to the next party I'm at in Lakeville, Connecticut, and tell somebody this story. you know, the 14 billion year story.
Yes.
Well,
the great story.
But I didn't necessarily succeed the first time I told somebody about that. And
mm-hmm.
so I started, nor did they even want to hear it.
Yeah.
I thought it was great, but they didn't. And so I began to learn to be a communicator from feedback, and then I get more insights about it, and then I get more feedback. So I don't think it's, I think it's a both and.
Yeah, yeah, that makes total sense. Well, there are several hands in the air here. I don't know your names, but if you called in with a phone that has an area code from Hackensack, New Jersey, I've just unmuted you. Please introduce yourself. Hello?
Hello?
201 area code? Yes, you're live.
I'm not in Hackensack, but hello.
Hi. What's
Terry,
your name?
Thank you so much. My name is Terry also. How are you?
Hi. Welcome.
Terry, thank you so much for having Barbara. And Barbara, I would so be remiss if I didn't say, oh, I'm tearing up, excuse me, if I didn't say thank you to you. You are just a wonderful teacher. Thank you.
Thank you.
I have been reading and following you for a while now. And although this question seems, I don't know how I feel about this question, but I am very curious on your take, because I've never heard you speak of it, on 2012.
Oh, my goodness. Thank you. I have a big thing to say on this. I am not a student of the Mayan prophecies, nor has that been my motivation. But I do believe that there is truth in the reality that something is coming to an end. A certain phase of human growth and human consciousness is not sustainable. And December 21st, 2012, does symbolically mark the ending also of the Mayan long calendar and marks the ending, at least symbolically, of a phase of evolution that cannot continue. So my passion for the 2012 is to say the day after the 21st is December 22nd, 2012, and I am now working with the Shift Network to celebrate on December 22nd, 2012, what we're calling Birth 2012, co-creating a planetary shift. And that the idea is to celebrate what's being born through us, what's being emerged through us, what innovations now are working toward a sustainable, evolvable world as the birth of a new culture. And what I know is that there are people everywhere, just like the ones on this phone, and all these teleseminars and all these hundreds of thousands of organizations and millions of people studying these books, God, that we are together a life form emerging on planet Earth, and we haven't yet fully connected and become aware that we're here together. So we're doing a celebration. You're all invited to find out. Just go on birth2012.com. It's on the Shift Network. And register your interest in it. And we see something like Earth Day, which has massive celebrations all over the world, each year to celebrate our love and care of the Earth. Birth Day is for our love and expression of our creativity and life purpose and visions of our future that we can co-create as we go through the crisis of birth towards a viable, co-evolving humanity. December 22nd, 2012 is going to mark the first birthday party for the emerging humanity. All cultures, all functions, all ages, all colors, all sizes, and everything.
Beautiful. Thank you so much, Barbara. I look forward to that.
Thank you.
Okay.
And so
thanks for your call, Terry.
We can be mothering and fathering the planetary birth.
That's
beautiful. You know, Barbara, just a quick follow-on question. So you're more or less saying, well, I don't particularly have some esoteric esoteric information that something or other is going to happen on that day, but I know that we're in the moment of a change, and with all of these people sensing something associated with that day, that's as good a day as any for us to bring our intentionality into focus, and therefore I'm choosing to do so, and in that way I'm regarding the 22nd of December of 2012 as day one of the next phase, because
that's
we
right.
need to own that transition at some point, and let's enact it, and here's a time that's been given just by the zeitgeist to think of something new happening, so let's grab hold of it and enact it. Is that
exactly.
reading you
that
right?
Is precisely. It's given to us by our culture, by the attention on December 21st. So this is exactly right, and it isn't about prophecies or that something will inevitably happen. In fact, it's just the opposite. It's saying it won't inevitably happen unless we at least consciously cultivate that which is emergent and creative.
Wonderful. That's great. That's great. A couple of the folks who've written in questions in the Instant Teleseminar window asked about Ray Kurzweil's work. One of them found it chilling, Cassandra, and then there's a fellow, Steve, from Scottsdale, who also asked about Kurzweil's work. Cassandra says, Kurzweil feels technology is evolving so fast that computers will have consciousness and surpass us, and evolution is calling us, and it almost feels as if we don't evolve as conscious humans, machines will do it for us, which is chilling. What do you think of this?
I think that that's only partially accurate. What he's saying, I think, is by 2045 that computer intelligence will be able to be so intelligent and self-correcting and self-learning and self-evolving that it will be a form of intelligence that has never existed before on this earth. The relationship between the humans who are creating this intelligence and that intelligence, when it goes through a singularity, like the formation of life out of pre-life was a singularity. It changed everything. And he's saying it's going to make a massive change with this degree of non-human intelligence. It's not that the humans are going to be the same thing or try to upload their consciousness in it or whatever. I think what Ray Kurzweil says is probably somewhat exaggerated but true. And there's no reason to assume that that's happening without our spiritual and social evolution also evolving. And what I see is that, let's say, computer intelligence is definitely complexifying and evolving. So is our spiritual intelligence. What do you think we're doing on this call? What do you suppose all of these teachers are out there doing by the thousands? We are evolving ourselves spiritually, personally. We're handling our relationships, our health, our vocations, our sense of the meaning of money, the sense of the meaning of all of our separate cultures. We are growing so fast. So I like to see the next stage of evolution to be a synthesis of spiritual, social, and scientific technological potential joined.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful. You know, there's another very different, and I'm very touched by this question. Carolyn from Grass Valley asks, what would you say to someone who had pretty clear seeing, in Adyashanti's words, and then had a stroke? And I seem to have lost a lot of the deeper sensing I had obtained over the years through the recovery process from the stroke. Do you have any insights or suggestions about that?
Well, in the generic and deep sense of it, I believe that every accident or illness or challenge has within it the drive towards something emergent. Perhaps even you being on the phone and asking this question means that you are exploring the meaning of a stroke for the own evolution of yourself and others. That means you're pushing the envelope of evolution by being here on this call, having had a stroke. And I think a lot, I had a son who died of a brain tumor 2 years ago, a terrible thing. And I was in the big cancer wards at Cedars-Sinai. And there were all these people dying of cancer and all these wizard doctors trying to defeat these very brilliant cancer cells. And you could see it was like warfare between the high-tech wizards of the medical profession and the high-tech genius of those cancer cells. And I began to think, okay, humanity, you're going to have to understand how that works. And Jonas Salk told me that we could do fairly well with germs that come from the outside, but the autoimmune diseases that are generated by our own cells and our own DNA are the ones where we have to learn how life works. So not that I can in any way rationalize the death of my son through this, but in the evolutionary point of view, the strokes, the cancer, the heart disease, all of these things are requiring us to go deep, deep, deep. How does it work? I actually see that's the meaning of all the crises. What do we do if this crisis is requiring us to evolve or die? So maybe I don't know how it has affected you, but you're on this call, you're asking this question, you're taking Terry's course. This is an evolutionary impulse, obviously, in you, that for anybody who has the stroke, you're going to be a guide and leader for them, and more.
Thank you, Barbara. I want to take another live question from a phone caller with a 610 area code. Looks like it's from Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, although I don't know where you are. You're alive. Please introduce yourself.
Yes, I am alive.
Yeah.
And I am in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, great city to be in. My name is Pat Herbst. I'm close to your age, Barbara. I'm a spiritual director, and your initial exchange really resonated within me, with the masculine and feminine, and with your understanding that women will lead the way in this shift, and Terry's kind of, well, where does that leave us men? And I'm in this too. One of the things I've experienced in spiritual direction is the focusing on the emergent self with the reproductive organs, both intellectually and meditatively, with men and with women. And it gives men somewhat of an experience of that joy, that aliveness that comes with a physical birth, and connecting it with the birth of themselves into this emergent self and wholeness. The other thing that I'm finding too, or that resonates with me in what you're saying, is the wholeness, completeness that we're each called to, and the androgynous self then that is neither masculine nor feminine, but a wedding or a union or a merging of those two dynamics within the person. And it seems to me that this is where the maturity level is called for in the handling of this new birth that you're speaking of. So you give me lots of language and names for what I'm experiencing with my vocation.
Oh, thank you. I have an intuition that, let's say, the biological female, as she emerges to become what I call the co-creative woman, the woman who is motivated by sourcing that divine creativity coming forward as her own unique creative expression, beginning to find its vocation and connection with others in the world in order to recreate a world that's viable for life, this woman has never been fully seen. This is a new archetype of the feminine co-creator who is creating a society that's sustainable and evolvable in which she could fulfill herself. For herself, her children, and her beloveds, everyone. Now, what's happening, therefore, is she's not just becoming a balance between the old masculine and the old feminine, she's taking the feminine further in its expression and bringing in a union with her own masculine that itself is going to go further than it or becomes emergent. But it's not just the old masculine. I think that's a phase of evolution. And it seems to me that the new man, the evolutionary man, is also becoming a new being. Because if he's balancing that masculine drive and that thrust and that genius and creativity with his deep feminine, receptive, nurturing side, that synthesis in the man makes for a new man. And the synthesis in the woman, co-creator, makes for a new feminine. And then them coming together to co-create beyond the reproductive phase continues to evolve both of them. So one of the things about me is I have a real sense of emergence and newness happening on Earth.
Well, that resonates and certainly brings arousal in this exchange.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for your question, Kathy. Take care. There's a question from Katie in Ottawa asking if you'd please speak of the importance of finding those of like mind with whom to commune as our evolutionary self awakens and opens to its full potential. In terms of what happens when we're in the midst of relationships that are not willing to move forward at the same time and at the same rate.
That's a very important question. It's delicate. I've experienced it before in my life quite frequently. I think one owes it to evolution, you might say, to seek out those you resonate with and stake out a claim for the development of that type of relationship while being compassionate and gentle and sharing the truth with people who are not attracted. But I really believe there's a morality of growth that's greater than the morality of maintenance.
Beautiful. Well, we have another live question, this one from someone with an 803 area code, which looks superficially like it might be from Columbia, South Carolina. Welcome. You're live. Hello, are you muted? Okay, that person isn't able to come on the line. We'll go on. There's someone from a 330 area code, which looks to me as if it's Youngstown, Ohio. You're live. Please introduce
Hello.
Yourself. Hi, welcome.
Terry?
Yes.
Hi, Terry. Barbara. Thank you. This is Dawn from Youngstown, and just a quick question, Terry. If you, as the male here, can address what's the seemingly preoccupation that men have with sex versus women having this preoccupation?
Well, the male sexual drive is a hugely powerful force, and to really discuss it with a thoroughness that does justice to all of what it touches on, you know, would take more time than I could respectfully take to respond with right now. One thing that I think is important to me, I think that men, you know, basically men feel a drive to impregnate young women. That's what the DNA is saying. You know, it's like the woman who looks like she could bear you healthy children is what, you know, what tends to bring that kind of arousal on. And it makes you want to become powerful and high status and therefore be able to stake claims on, you know, ultimately the urge is to stake claims on many women. You know, that's why back in the old patriarchy it was polygamous. At a certain level, of consciousness, though, we begin to realize that there's something about that urge that needs to be held in a larger picture. That urge is needs to be to some degree sublimated, expressed sexually, but also in other ways. And in fact, the graph of a male orgasm, which is kind of just builds to a climax, and then boom, it's over with. That's exactly the that's what we're trying not to do as a culture right now. As we speed up, we don't want to shoot our wad, as it were. We don't want to have a climactic explosion that leaves us without energy. But the nature of the game of evolution right now is to keep the game going. We really want to stay in the game. So I think that conscious men begin to realize with their sexual urge, I do, and I think this is, you know, what many of my friends confess, is this desire to do both, to hold a paradox in which there's a juiciness and there is a self-empowerment and there is aliveness that has ordinary sexuality to it, but it's also about caring for the whole and keeping things going, not just an urge for release or for discharge, but for sustenance. And I think that transmutation and sublimation of the kind of the grossest level of the sexual impulse is part of how men can become responsible citizens in this particular moment. Because if every man is just blindly driven by those biological urges, it's a recipe for disaster, and it's kind of what we're seeing manifest right now. This every man for himself selfish gene psychology is creating the crises that you know have to be transcended. And I think that responsible men have to counter that blind ambition in part. So it's not about denying and becoming less empowered and less effective and less strong and less positively related to juice and power and sexuality. Does that resonate for you, Don?
That's excellent. Thank you.
Sure.
Terry, I'd like to make a little addendum to what you said so well. And I once had this thought. I called it the plight of the lonely sperm. The sperm is a valiant little trooper, and it's always aiming at the egg. But 99 out of 100 times, there's no more egg, which is to say, the younger women, there's some form of contraceptive against conception. So the sperm can't get there. It's killed. Then the older women have no more eggs. And they're, instead of dying, they're continuing, and certainly their sexual life continues as well. So I asked a question of my partner many years ago, what do you think is the purpose of the sperm if it's not going to reproduce? Or only occasionally? You know, you think of it in the developed world where women have a choice. Most of the time they have sex, they don't want to have babies. And certainly after menopause, they're not going to have babies. So I began to ask, and this is just intuition, if what the woman really wants is regeneration and creativity, both from her partnership and in her own life, is sexuality regenerative when that's what the partners are looking for, not only procreative sex or recreational sex, but possibly regenerative sex?
Yes. Well, it's true. I think that some of that raw oomph that I feel finds its expression, a big part of it, really, at this point in my life, most of it finds its expression in this creativity that I'm doing at the level of spirituality and consciousness and transformation of culture and evolution. I'm making the world pregnant with what I am being given by the mystery of existence, and I feel sexually alive and potent in that service rather than in flirting with you know.
Exactly.
The checkout clerk or something.
It's cultural insemination.
Yes.
Where the seed of your genius, by going out, you know, I found this in the teleseminars on Shift Network, is my cultural seed is out way beyond what it was when I was just speaking to small groups and writing books.
Yes.
Because there's aliveness in this form of communication. Like right now on this phone with the people on the call, I feel it very deeply as a very alive interaction here.
Yes, absolutely. Well, Barbara, maybe that's the note. We're kind of here out of time at the end of our time. So thank you, everybody, for joining us. And thank you so much, Barbara. Before I say a little more about what's coming up next week and before we open up the line so we can hear each other's voices and say goodbye, a few reminders. If you value what you're receiving here, please support our work by letting others know about it. They can register for this series by going to beyondawakeningseries.com. And please also consider supporting my work in enriching your life by taking my course in integral spiritual practice at theispcommunity.com. And to learn more about my other work and see videos and audios and other writings, please visit integralspiritualpractice.com. I want to remind you again the tremendous array of rich resources from Barbara that you can connect with from her website, which is evolve.org. And I have an announcement from our sponsor, and some of you may have arrived here originally for this. You can learn about a career with heart and purpose by becoming a certified Calling in the One coach and create an extraordinary life of love, passion, freedom, and abundance from anywhere in the world in as little as 3 months. Catherine Woodward Thomas and Claire Zammit will be facilitating a live 5-day intensive as a part of their coaches certification training for their Calling in the One program later this month in person in Los Angeles. And you can find out all the details at callinginTheOneTraining.com. callinginTheOneTraining.com. Also, I want to let you know about the Integral Incubator. If you're inspired by an idea, a project, or a personal calling, you can bring it to a 5-day seminar at Boulder Integral that's designed to usher you into your next stage of effectiveness using your own work as your object of practice. It's led by my dear friend Jeff Salzman and includes a visit to integral philosopher Ken Wilber at his home. It's a unique way to workshop your idea into being. The next one starts at the end of this month on June 27th, and there'll be one other in 2011 in October. And you can find out more about that by going to integralincubator.com. Okay, a week from today, I am really excited to be in dialogue with Byron Katie, the originator of the work and one of the most fresh and disarming spiritual teachers of our time, in a dialogue entitled "The End Is Here." And I think it has a very optimistic and fresh and very present way of bringing you to her unique expression. You may know of her work. The phrase that summarizes it best is "loving what is." Then on June 26th, 2 weeks later, I'll be bringing in the voice of my teacher, Adi Das Amraj, by conducting a dialogue with a dear friend of mine and a devotee of Adi Da, Frank Marrero. And in July, I'll be talking again with Andrew Harvey on passion and evolution. In September, I'll be talking with A.H. Almas, also known as Hamid Ali, the founder of the Diamond Heart School, and in October with Bruce Lipton, the author of Spontaneous Evolution, and there are other remarkable conversations that we're kind of working on scheduling that I'll be able to announce in the time ahead. So thank you. Thank you, Barbara, and thank you, everybody, for joining us. Let's open up our phone line so that we can all hear each other's voices and say goodbye. Goodbye, everybody.
Bye.
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 Thank you.
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 Bye.
Thank you so much, Barbara.
You're welcome. Yes, thank you.
Thank you, Barbara. Thank you, Kai.
Okay, bye-bye.